This sermon begins in a bookstore. A long time ago, when first I came out here from Michigan to study in graduate school, and I found a thing that I had never known in the cultureless Midwest, specifically a used bookstore. I'd never seen one of those before, and I went wandering in a place that I found myself instantly drawn to. And there I found what, for the first time, drew me as a book that I would buy that had not been assigned to me and that I did not have to read for a class. It was a copy of Edward Gibbon's The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And I would really like you all to believe that I was drawn to it and bought it because I had in me a student of ancient history just waiting to get out. But that is not why I bought it. I bought it because of the binding. Now, if you don't know anything about Edward Gibbon's and the history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, you need to know that it is an immense book. It's 71 chapters long, and it was originally published in six volumes. The edition that I found there on the shelves of the old Star bookstore was bound into three volumes. And what I noticed immediately was the bindings of those volumes had beautiful Roman columns on them, two columns on each one of those thick books. But what you saw instantly was that very first column on the left of volume one was a perfect, beautifully drawn Roman column. But the next one was a little bit decayed, and more, so that by the time you got to the right-hand side of volume three, all that was remaining of that column was a pile of rubble. The design of those bindings just perfectly and wordlessly conveyed all of the ideas in all of those hundreds of pages in those three thick books. Rome, the great achievement of the ancient world, begun as a republic that expressed in political structures the civic virtues of its citizens. And then it becomes an empire focused on conquest and domination, and the citizens somehow become willing to trade their virtues for monetary gain. And eventually the whole empire finally collapses because its citizens no longer possessed the self-discipline and the virtue that had built their republic in the first place. The basic idea of Gibbon's history has become for us a kind of essential idea, a cultural trope. We sort of relate to it as the inevitable way that history follows the laws of physics, and specifically that bit about what goes up must come down. Nations rise and nations fall. Egypt, Athens, Rome, Byzantium, the Incas, the Aztecs, the Spanish, the British, the French. The story of human civilization is a story of ups and downs, ascendance and decline. That seems as much a law of nature as the fact of human mortality. And living as we do in this remarkable nation, at this turbulent moment in history, sometimes we wonder where we might be on the arc of rise and fall. Of course, our ancestors wondered about that very same question. There's nothing new about that particular brand of worry. Rise and fall is the human story. It's a reflection at the largest scale of our own frailty as human beings. We love to believe otherwise. And from time to time, we are absolutely certain, as Dr. Pangloss said, that this is all for the best in this best of all possible worlds. That every day, in every way, things are getting better and better. But then we are confronted with the hard edges of reality. and we come to a different view. Now, I am not saying all this to start out your Lent on a downer. There is a method to this misery. The point of all this is to make a contrast between our lives in history and our lives in God. Because it turns out that our lives in God, the lives of our eternal souls, head in a different direction and toward a different destination. Just this past week on Ash Wednesday, we started one more time the season of Lent. Our lives in history are played out in the cycles of days and weeks and years, and the church gives us the gift of a way of moving through those cycles with an order, a structure that we would otherwise have to invent for ourselves. But because we don't have to do that, we can instead focus on the ideas that unfold week by week, season by season, in the calendar of the church. Anticipation, preparation, incarnation, manifestation, self-examination, penitence, sacrificial passion, resurrection, discipleship. Those aren't the names of the seasons, but in a very simple way, that is the sequence of ideas that is set before us again and again. And if we take it even just a little bit more seriously every year, each time around, we can explore those ideas just a little more deeply. Where we are headed in this season of Lent is to the cross and the grave, and in the end, the empty tomb and the defeat of death itself. But dear friends, none of that makes a lot of sense. None of that really counts for much to any of us unless we start at the beginning and understand how our story starts, the book of Genesis. And that is why we began there this morning. Now let's establish what the book of Genesis is not. The book of Genesis is not an astrophysics textbook. The book of Genesis is not a record of the historical creation of the universe, the planet, and the creatures. But we are so often anxious to say what it is not that we are in danger of forgetting what it is. And this is what it is. The book of Genesis is a map of the universal human spiritual journey. It is an account of the situation from which we all begin. And it is only by fully taking that on board that we can have anything like an appreciation of just what is so insanely joyful about Easter. Let's just say for a minute that we accept the account of creation given to us by science. That gives us a set of ideas about how we came to be who we are. We are here as we are, rather than some other species or some other kind of human, because certain kinds of traits turned out to be more advantageous in helping us to survive instead of others. Some of those traits we have wisely come to regard as virtues, to be treasured and encouraged and celebrated. Things like altruism and socially constructive behavior and stable long-term commitments between pairs who raise children, and actions that put the interests of others clearly and squarely ahead of one's own self-interest. And some of these things we come to admire just because they're examples of the highest expression of our humanity, feats of strength or athletic skill or intellectual prowess or creative ability. All that's good. But what comes with all of that are some other things that helped us to survive that are not so good. We instantly and automatically make assumptions about every other human we meet. We place great stock in observable differences, things like eye color, or size, or race, or gender. We make meaning out of the structure of someone's face or out of how they speak or walk. We are hardwired to create rank and to put some people and often ourselves above others. What comes with all of our great skill and our tremendous advantages is an equally large share of stuff that makes us dangerous to ourselves and others. The things about us that are the best, the things about us that are the image and likeness of God in our hearts and our minds, we can do serious damage to those virtues in ourselves and in other people. That tendency, that dangerous inclination, and all the stuff that comes from it, that is what we mean when we say, here it is, original sin. We don't like the sound of that phrase. It makes us feel bad or judged before the evidence. So we try to explain it away or throw it out as old thinking or oppressive. But paradoxically, friends, it is actually liberating. Because if we try to throw it out, we also throw out an understanding, not just of the trouble we're in, but of the way of getting out of it. St. Paul, writing to the church in Rome. And for him, old Adam is a stand-in for everything I just said. We are caught up in Adam's sin for the simple reason that we are human. And Adam is that first human who found himself snared in that trap between tremendous skill for good and tremendous tendency for trouble. Adam's prison is our prison. We did not make it for ourselves. You might almost say that it made us. This prison of the quest to endure and survive over hundreds and thousands of years that made us both skilled and suspicious, both capable and culpable, that is where we are stuck. That is the death we cannot escape. Racism, intolerance, indifference to suffering. All of that is the death that traps us. It comes with our coding. And in the end, so does the fact of our mortality, which is what pushes us so hard to struggle for survival in the first place. That is the trap we are in. To say it in different words, unlike the rest of history, we don't rise and fall. We start with the fall. Our lives in God start with the fall. Lent is a reenactment in the tiny space of 40 days of our whole story of salvation, a story that exactly reverses the way the rise and fall cycle explains the rest of history. We do not start in some high and lofty place and come crashing down like a collapsing empire. Our spiritual story starts with the fall, with the poor reflexes and the self-destructive instincts that are quite literally baked into our DNA. And we end by being given a path out of that trap. The bars of the prison that made us, and which we in turn made stronger, are shattered completely. That is what is done for us by the person, the teaching, the actions, the sacrifice, and the resurrection of Christ. And here is how he does it. Every one of our lesser tendencies, our hesitant generosity, our reflexive rank ordering, our insistence on inventing some kind of meaning out of the differences we see in others, absolutely every one of those things, Jesus completely upends by the example of his life. He shows us what a life would look like, how it would be lived, what it would sound like if it were not beholden to any of those weaknesses. The greatest gift of all, the gift of Easter, is the gift of some way of overcoming the weaknesses ourselves, and for finding ourselves a path that leads us back up to the high place where we were meant to be. All of that gets packed into these 40 days of Lent. So my prayer for us, my request for all of us, is that we somehow find in the routine of every day a moment, just one moment, to think about the ways we feel trapped in that prison. The ways we feel somehow caught up in a place we know is less than where God intends for us to be. Mired down and stuck right here and unable to move up higher. Because then this season will be more than an old story. It'll become what it is meant to be, a way of taking stock of the extent of our trouble and a way of finding the way God is giving us to walk out of this prison. Amen.